This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Welcome to 5Live. We've got a few movies to discuss. In fact, Mark, we're going to discussing the following movies.
We're going to be discussing the new Michael Haneke film. We're going to be discussing...
What's that called?
It's called The White Ribbon.
The White Ribbon,
yes. And we're going to be discussing 2012, which is the new disaster movie. You and I were on the telly yesterday talking about World in Peril movies.
There is something about 2012 that...
I figured out 2012.
Yeah, well, I put on Twitter this morning, what are the chances of 2012 being,
yeah,
the movie of, being the movie of the week? And overwhelmingly people said, well, I think the odds are like 20 to 12.
20 to 12, yes. Probably.
But it's almost like it doesn't matter what anyone says about it.
Well,
it's a big... It's a big, huge,
dumb
disaster movie in which the world ends. You know, what's not to like?
Yeah, well, there's two things. That can I give you this anyway? I know you said you didn't want another coffee, but I got it for you anyway because I feel redundant if I don't get it.
All right, that's very kind. Hey, how fantastic having Mark Knopfler playing.
I know, wasn't
it? David Tennant, I mean, quite extraordinary.
I was following on from David Tennant telling you that you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. Did you notice how starstruck I was both of those times? I was actually genuinely quite wobbled.
But appropriately so.
Yes, no, appropriately so.
And Harry Brown as well. We're going to talk about Harry Brown. Lots of emails
Harry
about
Brown.
And lots of emails about that because it opened on Wednesday, so a lot of people have seen it already.
Yes.
So let's do the box office top 10. And then
before you do that, I just want to say very quickly, when he was holding the Dobro and then he started playing the opening of Romeo and Juliet, I thought, I'm going to have a moment here. I'm saying it's impossible not to, isn't it? Because it is that particular sound and it is that riff. And so I'm sorry, I had a little...
But what was terrific about it is that he's at ease with his back catalogue. Because a lot of people
clearly,
come in
and
say, if I'd said, do you think you could play Romeo and Juliet? I'd have thought, really, that's a stupid thing.
But that's what Lou Reed does, isn't it? Lou Reed stands up and lectures people. Now sit down and stop enjoying yourself. I've got an entire album to get through. We're going to be here for some time.
Just don't mention anything old or popular.
Yes.
So let's do a box office top 10 because it's Couples Retreat at number 10.
Somebody sent me a newspaper cutting. I haven't got it here, which had a fantastic review which said that Couples Retreat was over full of laughs.
Robin Swindon.
Which it really isn't.
Whilst enduring The Crime Against Cinema, which is the new Vince Vaughn movie, a chap in the row behind's phone went off. Whilst this would normally be a source of annoyance to me, on this occasion it was an excellent commentary on the film, as the ringtone in question was a Fall Out Boy song, for which the chorus is, if this is a rom-com, kill the director.
is that a song?
Yeah, and he's suggesting, now I'm not quite sure how widespread this
you
is going to work.
Are you familiar with that song?
No, I'm not.
Okay,
right.
Fine.
Have any of your listeners had a similarly pithy review of a film from a fellow cinema goer's mobile
ringtone?
Now, I'm not sure that's going to work as a game, but, mention it just in case.
Yeah. Can we say we're not encouraging people to have their mobile phones in cinemas, nor, indeed, to Twitter from screenings, Simon Mayo.
I would only do it if I was on my own, in which case it doesn't matter.
That's not true, because people have Twittered that they have seen you Twittering. You're calling your fellow Twitterers liars?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, fine. As long as we're clear about
that. And education's at number 9.
No, I still haven't caught up with it.
This is terrible, because you're going to have to, because it's going to win awards.
And I know, everyone says it's great. I'm really looking forward to going to it, but I couldn't see it this week because I had to go to the Isle of Man to do something for Culture Show, so that was where I was.
Colin in Sutton. Excuse me, it's Colin Baker, actually. But probably not
the Colin Baker.
Dear Kiki and Zaza, I was surprised that Education was only number 8 in the box office top 10 last week until I realised that it has had limited distribution.
Yes.
Don't the distributors know that there is a market for films with high quality plot and acting and not just the latest special effects laden product or Disney Pixar cartoons with mass audience appeal? Well, certainly, if you do find it, it's worth travelling 10 or 15 miles because it's
But can I also say that, actually, funny enough, it's a throwback to the way it just generally thought it was this. If a movie is terrible, you open it everywhere on the same day so that you get your crowds in before anyone hears how bad it is. If a movie is good, traditionally, the way you did it was you opened it in a limited number of screens and then you allowed its reputation to grow. It's not necessarily a bad thing that something doesn't open everywhere at the same time, particularly nowadays when, I'll guarantee you, for example, that 2012 will be opening everywhere today.
We have...
Saw 6.
Saw 6 at number 8.
There have been on Twitter many people doing the I see Saw 7.
Well, what we got here is Tom, BSc Engineering, RAF, listening to the podcast in Kandahar, sunny Kandahar. Dear Saws 1 and 2, who saw more Saw shown in screen 4? I hear tell Saws hell. How does 6 Saws sell? What else have we got?
They are so much more fun than the films.
Andy Anderson, dear Sergeant Foley and Mayonnaise, you missed an obvious kid's tongue twister. I saw Esau queuing up to see Saw. I saw Esau, he saw me. Nick Austin, dear Borman and Goodhart, I think we can draw a line under the debate surrounding the most entertaining thing about Saw 6, the inanity of it, summing up how boring this franchise is and always has been. In French, the staggeringly original title, Saw 6, is brilliantly transformed into Saw 6. Which, when pronounced correctly, sounds identical to the French word for sausage, which is saucisse. Thanks for keeping me with the tank. So,
sausage. Let's call it sausage from now on. It is sausage.
That is the end of that particular debate. And we have fantastic Mr.
No, you missed out. You've jumped over Jennifer's body. Megan Fox.
Seven, Jennifer's body then.
Megan Fox. Probably the best film she will ever make. I enjoyed it. It's had some fairly stinky reviews, which I was surprised by. I think that Diablo Cody is a good screenwriter. As I said, I think she's going to grow out of the tick of writing like Diablo Cody. But I think it's a well put together sort of genre homage that knows its horror films. And it's just nice to see one of those things done by somebody who clearly knows the groundwork.
Apparently, Kill the Director is a chorus from The Wombats and not Fallout Boy. But I was just reading the email, but I should have known, of course, that it's The Wombats and it's not Fallout Boy.
The Wombats are whom?
It's their band called The Wombats.
Of Wimbledon Common.
Fantastic Mr. Fox at number 6. Is that stupid, silly comment there? Anne, BAMA, pre-Columbian and Native American art and architecture, dears S&M, since he was 4 weeks old, I've taken my son to a parent and baby screening almost every week.
Okay.
The lights are a bit brighter, so you can see to feed or change baby, and the sound is a bit quieter, so he can fall asleep. He's now 6.5 months. Yesterday, we went to see Fantastic Mr. Fox, purely because it was on. I was not overly enthusiastic following The Good Doctor's review, and I have to say he was completely right about it being an adult film, and I think that the worst example of this is the swearing. Just taking out four-letter words and replacing them with three-letter ones, because they basically say
cuss.
They say cuss all the way through. There is no need for cuss this and cuss that or cuss off. It actually made me quite angry that this is targeted at children. I found the whole thing in bad taste and quite uncomfortable. I did not titter once.
I have no problem with that comment at all. I think it proves exactly that the problem with the film is that it's like it's above children in the filmmaker's mind, and I think that's a very bad place to be.
The Fourth Kind is at 5.
The Fourth Kind at 5, and the whole thing about The Fourth Kind is, you know, it's a true story, but you know what? It isn't. And you know what? It isn't any good either.
The Men Who Stare at Goats at 4, alternatively The Fantastic Mr. Goats. Here we go. David Manchester, dear Dirk Diggler and Chest Rockwell. Well, I think I'll be Chest Rockwell. Watch The Men Who Stare at Goats as the opening feature of the Leeds Film Festival, and highly entertaining it was too, easily surpassing the required number of laughs, titters and guffaws on the Curdon Momometer.
Good.
Its failure, however, was in repeatedly asking the audience to laugh at some hapless fools who believe they have actual psychic powers when really they don't, then suggesting that actually sometimes they do. Forget psychic spying. Anyone who can predict the toss of a coin over 200 times in a row should surely turn his back on soldiering for a more lucrative career as lottery winner, whilst cloud bursting would be pretty useful this close to the Pennines in autumn. All very amusing, but, says Dave, a more cynical film could have kept the laughs whilst making a clearer political point about the idiocy and wasted resources of this military project, as well as its eventual descent into torture.
I think it is true that there is a lack of cynicism in The Men Who Stare at Goats, but I was surprised by how much of John Ronson's, what's that awful phrase, sideways view of the world there is.
I think
is.
It's always a sideways glance.
Okay, fine. Well, view askew or whatever it is. Essentially, for a mainstream movie, I thought it was surprisingly left field. But I agree, it's not cynical. It's not cynical in the way, for example, that Catch-22 is, or even that MASH is.
Sam, writing from
I liked it.
Geneva. Dear Tweedledee and Tweedledum, I heard the Good Doctor mention in the Men Who Stare at Goats review that barring The Big Lebowski, when Jeff Bridges walks on screen, Mark gets happier. Mm. Okay, let me say these things. One.
Yeah, here we go.
You obviously haven't seen Masked and Anonymous. It's a film co-written and starring Bob Dylan, co-written and directed by Larry Charles of Curb Your Enthusiasm fame, and also starring Jeff Bridges, John Goodman, Penelope Cruz, Luke Wilson, Val Kilmer. The list goes on. Everything about it is terrible.
Oh, really? Okay.
Plot acting, directing, the way it's filmed, and Bridges comes out of it smelling as bad as every single actor
in the film. Okay.
Which no doubt has something to do with the fact that many of them worked for free just to be in a film with Bob Dylan. For me, the only semi-saving grace is the music, as Mark has made his feeling clear on Bob's music. I'm sure he'd hate this film. So please watch it. Two, you are very wrong about The Big Lebowski, although I'm sure that greater people than me have tried to convince you otherwise and have failed.
There's been so many people now saying you've got to go back and watch Big Lebowski again, and I am going to do it. I don't hold many big hopes for it, because I think I was quite open-minded the first time, but I am going to go see it.
Right, we'll whip through these, okay. Then we can start the new releases. So it's up at three.
Fine, you don't need 3D.
Michael Jackson's This Is It at two.
It's not a film, but you know what? If Elvis had pegged out Leaving Behind that kind of footage, I would want to see it.
A Christmas Carol is at number one, not as good as A Muppet Christmas Carol.
Not as good as A Muppet Christmas Carol, not as good as Mickey's Christmas Carol, not as good as many other Christmas carols, and many more chase sequences than I remember being in the original literary source. And also, once again, the 3D. 3D, bloody, bloody.
What are we going to do first?
We're going to do White Ribbon
first. White Ribbon, okay. We'll do White Ribbon next as our first review. Get that. That might be a review before 20 past three, which is a very, very rare thing.
It is.
Karen. MSc, PhD, Clinical Neuroscience.
Oh, wow.
Dear Evil and Dead, I'm writing to you from Sweden with some good news for Mark.
Yes.
One of our newspapers had an interview with Judd Apatow. It was a rather sick-inducing piece. Well, Mr. Judd described, thank you, his own work as, quote, depicting both men and women with all their faults and flaws rather than simply showing women as objects for someone else's desire. Mm-hmm. But his finishing remark was that he's now going to take a year off to gain new inspiration. Hopefully this means Mark won't have to see any Apatow films for quite a while, thereby preventing heart attacks, indigestion and silent strokes. Have a great weekend, says Karen.
I love it when people take years off. It's like when people, when people threaten, or is it promised, to never make films again. It always makes me very happy.
So, let's talk about stuff that's new. There's some big movies with big posters to discuss and a few others.
Well, let's start with The White Ribbon. I always get criticised for going in the last, few seconds of the show. Oh, and the film of the week is, for example...
Well, don't tell us what the film of the week is already, because then some people might switch off.
Okay, so I won't tell you what the film of the week is already, but let's start in a break from tradition with Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon. That's the poster for it, which is the picture of the kid looking sinister and the Palme d'Or logo. Michael Haneke is basically the master of the cinema of unease, in as much as he makes films that make you feel profoundly uneasy. It's set in a remote rural community just before World War I, and it opens, it's in black and white, and it opens with this very deadpan voiceover telling you that what we're about to see is a story which will clarify some of the things which happened at this particular time. And it's a classic Michael Haneke thing that you start with somebody saying, what I'm about to do is to tell you these things in order to clarify some events. And of course, what the film does is obfuscate beyond comprehension. So the clarification, there is none. What there is the tagline for one of the posters, not this poster, unfortunately. One of the posters has got the tagline, "Who burned down the barn?" To which the answer is, I don't know. No, and that's the point of the film.
Is that the barn in The Archers?
No, it's the barn in The White Ribbon.
Didn't Grace Archer die in that?
I don't do The Archers.
No, I don't either.
Although I turned it on the other day and somebody's done a runner and is in Ibiza or something.
There was a barn that burned down, and I think that's when Grace...
Okay, I'd like to hear Michael Haneke directing The Archers. I'm not sure how that would work.
Quentin Tarantino doing The Archers, that'd be fun.
Yeah, anyway, okay, so the story is it's in a remote rural community just on the eve of World War I. A couple of things start happening. One of them is that the local doctor is riding around on a horse, which gets tripped by a tripwire. He falls and hurts himself. Who put the tripwire there? Who knows? Then the young son of a local baron is kidnapped and apparently tortured, and he turns up again. Who did it? Then another child is treated very, very badly, and the local kids appear to be very concerned for his safety. Or are they? And then other members of the community start to turn upon each other and to suspect each other, or do that. And it's one of those films in which... Did you see Hidden? Ever seen Hidden Cachet? You saw it, yes? The one with Danny Otto, in which there's a couple living in an apartment and somebody starts sending them videotapes. They're being threatened, but they're not quite sure what they're being threatened with.
And I'm not sure I did.
You didn't see it? No, I don't think you did, because I think you would have told me if you had. It was a very acclaimed...
I only go and see what you tell me to go
and
see.
I did tell you to go and see that, but I think you would remember if you did. Anyway, the point about Hidden was it was one of those films in which there was this sense of, you know, creeping sort of paranoia. And it's a film about paranoia, much the same way as, for example, David Lynch's Broken Highway is a film about... Lost Highway is a film about paranoia. So what you have here is... a group of events, none of which are fully explained, but all of which seem to suggest that something really, really, really bad is about to happen. Now, if you're familiar with Michael Haneke's back catalogue and you've seen things like Funny Games and you've seen things like Benny's Video, to which, incidentally, this does owe some debt, you are aware that Haneke's films can make things that are really, really bad happen. The real strength of The White Ribbon is that it's not the really bad thing happening that's terrifying. It's the sense that the really bad thing is about to happen, which is
really... Can you give us an example of what might be a really bad thing and a really, really bad thing?
Okay, really bad thing would be a scene that makes you go, oh, blimey. A really, really bad thing would be a scene that, as in Funny Games, in which you think, not only, oh, blimey, but you know what, I'm going to leave. And in fact, in the case of Funny Games, the film kept pointing at the audience and going, why aren't you leaving? Why aren't you leaving? Why aren't you leaving? And I got quite cross with it. And I felt like standing up and going, you know what, the reason I'm not leaving, Mr. Haneke, this is my job. I have to stay, but if it wasn't, I would leave. Stop lecturing me about the morals of horror films, which he has definitely got over. So it's filmed in black and white, which kind of to some extent has that kind of Bergman-esque austerity, but also acts as a distancing mechanism. The kids in the village reminded me of nothing more than The Village of the Damned. Have you seen The Village of the Damned, the Wolf Thriller film of the John Wyndham book?
Many years ago.
But you're fine. Okay, you remember the kids in it, the sort of the blonde, they look like kind of proto-fascist kids who are all joined together with
Why
a kind of collective
unconscious. Why is being blonde proto-fascist?
Well, the kids in Village of the Damned clearly are.
They're My blonde kids are blonde.
No, they're they're blonde-haired, blue-eyed, they all have an unconsciousness which they are all joined in. And this is in... Yeah, fine.
Well, I realise
I'm not saying that being blonde means you're a fascist. Saying that they are... No, clearly that's not the case. But they are... There is going on in the Village of the Damned. And clearly...
It's an Aryan thing.
Yes, it's an Aryan thing. Thank you. And in terms of White Ribbon, there is a sense that these kids are very sinister and they are involved in something and you're not quite sure what it is, but you know that it's something sinister. And, of course, many critics have pointed out the fact that they are going to be the kids who will then grow up through the First World War and then will go on to be the kids who effectively bring us, you know, Nazism. And to a great extent, the film is about laying the ground. It's about a dysfunctional community and it's about the way in which the groundwork is laid for some coming atrocity. And in a way, the coming atrocity is, in fact, World War II, although it's coming a very, very long way away. But the real strength of the film is, and I have to say, I think it's a very powerful piece of work, that it doesn't matter how much the critics care to analyse all the, you know, what does this mean and what does that mean and this history. What it is it has that genuine sense of, I'm really uneasy about this, I'm really uneasy, I'm really very, very uneasy about this. And it's a real skill in delivering a movie that genuinely works as a horror film without descending into the sort of, you know, the excesses of something like Funny Games. I mean, it's funny, you watch the kids in the film and it's never quite explained what it is about what they're doing that's so disturbing. And you think, I'm really worried in that. And it treads for me a very thin line between being on the one hand, you know, a political social satire, and on the other hand, a paedophobic horror tract. I'm very interested in films that are about the fear of children. I mean, that's, you know, partly why Exorcist I think is important. That's partly why Village of the Damned I think is important. There is a very, very sort of strong sense of this. But it is one of the most anxious experiences I can remember in the cinema. Now, I know that saying black and white movie that doesn't explain anything and is you are going to come out of it feeling profoundly anxious and wound up may not sound like the greatest recommendation.
Not really, no.
But believe me, it is anxiety on a clinically sort of honed, you know, precise... It's precise anxiety. That's what it is. It's precision anxiety.
Targeted,
yes.
Targeted anxiety.
Like smart bomb precision anxiety. And I felt really uncomfortable, and I've now seen it twice. And the second time around, even knowing what I knew about it, the way that the story works out, I felt no less uncomfortable. The other thing that's worth saying...
Do you come out anxious? I mean, is there not a resolve to the anxiousness?
No, you come out feeling very angry. Because what you do is you come out thinking that somehow you've been part of a community that has been poisoned during the course of the film. And you sort of feel some of that poison. Although there are moments in it that are sort of oddly human for Haneke. I mean, I think Haneke is getting better and better. I think what he's done is he's got out... When he started out making, he was like a stern lecturer who would just... His films were like lectures telling you off. You know, this, people are watching these films, that they are very violent, you're a horror film fan, therefore I'm going to give you a very bad time, you're going to be told off for doing it. You see my Benny's video? Yes, well now you sit down again, you say, oh, you didn't understand it in Austria, I'm going to remake it again in English, that time you will understand it because you're very bad. Now he's gone, okay, fine, you know what? Let's do something else.
Well, he's lost the accent. He's become English.
He is Austrian. I mean, you know.
Well, not anymore.
No. Well, this film is not in the English language. It's a subtitled black and white film about precision anxiety. How's that for a recommendation? And it's great.
On that kind of link to that, Davy in Belfast. I've recently watched Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yes.
I've watched it many times and enjoyed Mark's feature on it. Having put the disc in the player, I made the decision to watch the movie in black and white.
Weird, really?
Weird Davy. For me, it gave the film a different feel. I've always felt that this was a movie that could have been made in black and white, even though clearly the end of the movie and his escape takes place in in a recent time period when films would obviously have been made in colour. It didn't detract from my enjoyment in watching this superbly crafted movie in a different format. With all the talk about 3D, does Mark think any other films may possibly benefit by taking the colour out?
Well, the classic thing, of course, is that Rocky Horror Show is meant to be in black and white until the moment that they get to Frank's arrival, because it's Wizard of Oz. You know, it starts in black and white and then it goes into colour. That was meant to be in black and white. And there are plenty of examples of films in which the director has wanted them to be in black and white, and the producers have insisted that they shoot them in colour, and then if you want to do a black and white version, they'll drain them out, but then the colour is there so that when they come to put it on television, they can turn it back into colour. Having said there are plenty of examples, I now struggle to think of one because I'm old and, you know, losing my memory, but there are plenty of examples. That's nowadays how you would be forced to do it.
See, I'm not quite sure I understand the argument, because the oral equivalent of that is to say, let's take a pristine quality piece of music and make it sound muffled.
No, that's completely not true. No, I mean, think about Eraserhead.
Well, No.
You're imagining in your philistinic way that somehow black and white is a poorer, you know,
if it's lifelike.
If we could have all these colours, why only have two?
No, I'm just saying it's realistic.
If we could have 3D, why only have two? If we could have quintophonic sound, why only have two? Of course, the essence of it is, if you light a film to be shot in black and white, that's completely different to lighting it in colour, which is why directors rail against this. Because if you're shooting a film that's meant to be done in black and white, I'll tell you another example is Young Frankenstein, the Mel Brooks film. He had to fight for Young Frankenstein to be done in black and white.
There's
and
an argument for that because it's a period piece.
Yeah, but in fact, all the production stills for Young Frankenstein were all in colour, because they attempted to suggest to the audience that it was a colour film because they knew that people would be put off by the idea that it's black and white. The idea that somehow black and white is a lesser version of colour is completely wrong. You light for monochrome in one way, you light for colour in another. Eraserhead wouldn't have been a better film if it was in colour. You don't really think that. Have you seen Eraserhead?
Yes, I have seen Eraserhead.
Right, and you think that Eraserhead would have been better if it had been in colour?
Well, part of me does, actually.
Yeah, you know the thing that David Tennant was saying about you're the best broadcaster on the world? Yeah, you like Earthsong and you think Eraserhead would have been better in colour. Yeah, you're going to love 2012. You are, in fact, going to love James Cameron's Avatar.
I am. You know. I suspect I am. But you've just given away what you're thinking.
About what?
About 2012. You said you're going to love it because you're saying it.
You might be right. I'll move on to 2012. You know, as soon as, and you never know, it might be a masterpiece. But on the subject, the other thing I wanted to say about White Ribbon is, in terms of the things that it owes a debt to, the voiceover also owes a debt to the voiceover from Lars von Trier's Dogville. There is that similar sense of somebody narrating a story that is completely at odds with the story that they're telling you, and they're saying it in a way which is totally deadpan. And actually, I think that I know everyone talks about somehow Haneke being the great master and von Trier being the kid who misbehaves himself. I think in this particular case, Haneke is not only looking towards Bergman and Riller and all that sort of stuff, he's actually also looking towards Lars von Trier.
See, I actually think, I remember we started this conversation many years ago when Shane Meadows' 24/7 came out. See, I don't think that benefited from being in black and white. I don't quite understand why that's in black and white.
Mm. And you think, presumably, that Manhattan would have been better if it had been in 3D, right?
No.
Do you think Manhattan would have been better if it was in colour? Do you not?
I don't know. I don't
believe that you mean this. I think you're just saying it to be contrary. You do understand, don't you, that there is a completely different thing about lighting monochrome than to lighting colour?
Tim in Nottingham, dear
yes,
Agent
yes, you do
K
understand that.
And Agent J, last week I heard your The Men Who Stare at Goats review, and I thought you said The Men Who Stare at Coats. Well, now that would be quite a different film. I'm not sure that would work.
No.
But we're back to that. J just change one letter.
Yes,
and
we
see
are.
What happens.
I want to get on to 2012. I know we got.
It's half past three.
I know. I want to get on to 2012.
Well,
after
I do too. And also the Michael Caine film. We need to talk about that.
Can I tell you what film of the week is?
David Ritchie is The White Ribbon.
Yeah, of course it is.
Okay. I don't think that's a big surprise. David Ritchie, BA Theatre, Film and Science Subjects, Victoria University of Wellington, New Zealand. Dear Doctors Fu Manchu and is it Phoebes?
The Abominable Dr. Fibes.
Fibes, beg your pardon. A quick note of appreciation for Dr. K's Tom Waits impersonation. That's it.
I'm guessing you're not a betting man.
This Saw correspondence,
yes.
Mark, we're now moving into Dr. Seuss territory.
Okay, yes.
This from Steve in Belfast. I saw Saw 2 too. Saw 3 I did not see. What a bore was Saw 4. Saw 5, man alive. So number 6 and I won't mix. That's pretty good.
That's very, very good. All of them are funnier than the film.
Matt in Durham.
Yep.
And a whole bunch of other people. Dear Sam and Gertie, I saw a trailer for 2012 yesterday, and I noticed that the film has received a 12A rating for, quote, sustained moderate threat and one use of strong language. For me, if the world as we know it was being completely destroyed, I might be more than moderately threatened. If the annihilation
sustained
of our,
moderate threat.
If the annihilation of our planet is only moderately threatening, albeit sustained over a bum-numbing 158 minutes, what would be classed as a strong threat? Just a thought. Anyway, a number of people making the same point.
No,
anyway.
It is exactly right. And once again, brilliantly, the BBFC have provided the best review of the film in saying that it contains a sustained moderate threat and one use of strong language. That is basically what you need to know. Now, look... to get into the movie itself, firstly, I want to dispel any idea that I'm somehow sniffy about or above disaster movies as such. I really like Independence Day. I think Day of the Earth Stood Still, the original, is great. We were talking about disaster movies on the Terrible and World in Peril movies last night. I made a documentary about the Towering Inferno and the Poseidon Adventure. I think Irwin Allen was a real, genuine cinema genius. I don't have anything against the disaster movie genre when done properly. What I have is a problem with films that are plain and simple bad. Now, in the case of 2012, it is no surprise to say that it is plain and simple bad. But just as a bit of a setup, the story is the world is going to hell in a handcart because the center of the world is heating up because of some solar flares. And that means that the molten core is going to change and you're going to get crust movement. So here's a clip, it'll explain it.
The temperature of the subterranean crust, that is the cement that holds our landmass in place, is increasing at a rapid rate much faster than anticipated. As a result, we've observed extreme polar instability. The magnetic fields have decreased by more than 80% in the last 48 hours.
How much time do we have, Dr. Hemsley?
2, maybe 3 days if we're lucky.
How can you speak about luck in such a situation?
Apologies, Mr. Prime Minister. I meant no disrespect.
I'm afraid the longer we wait, the more luck plays its part.
How much longer do we
have? I know,
have?
But you can see... already you get this sense, you know, it's an American movie with the American worldview, is that there is America, and then there's a bunch of countries in which people talk with funny accents like this, and there is one moment in it in which they're talking about... Because the story is, okay, world is going to come to an end. Oh, blimey, what are we going to do? It turns out that some ships are being built that will save the remnants of humanity. I'm not giving away too much of the plot because this is all in the trailer. And the question then about who is going to get on the ships that are going to save humanity. And... there is one bit in it in which it turns out that the American leader is going to go down with the ship. He's going to go down with the Earth.
If the ship's going to go down, then there's no point.
No, he's going to go down with the Earth. And somebody says, and we've already seen the Queen scuttling onto one of the ships. But somebody says, oh, yes.
Which Queen?
Our Queen. Yes, but the Italian Prime Minister is apparently staying. Eh? What? So, you know, here are the two great positives. We are going down with the Earth, you know, America and the Italian Prime Minister, which sounds unlikely. Meanwhile, the Brits, in the shape of her M, the Q, is running as fast as she can to get on the ship. Okay, now... The problems with the film are manifold. We start with the fact that running time, nothing needs to be the best part of 2 hours, 40 minutes long. And blimey, Charlie, do we feel every minute those 2 hours, 40 minutes. The whole idea that the Earth's core is melting down, incidentally, that plot is nicked from Dalek Invasion Earth 2150 AD, in which the Daleks come down to Earth, heat up the Earth's core in order to mine out the center of it so that they can turn the Earth into a spaceship. So all this stuff about, the Mayans predicted it. The Mayans, who, incidentally...
get blamed for everything nowadays, and ever since Mel Gibson proved that it's basically possible to make a successful movie vaguely leaning toward the Mayan sense, oh, everything's Mayan, everything, oh, the Mayans predicted it, so oh, 2012 coming. I have a theory.
Is that the equivalent of Nostradamus? Is it, oh, you know, yeah, yeah. Who predicted everything?
Yeah, exactly. Or you know, the Bermuda Triangle, that'll do that, or you know, whatever it is. It's just the get out of jail free ticket. And as far as the 2012 thing is concerned, let me say simply, the reason the movie is called 2012 is this. You released the original version of it, this version, in 2009. It comes out on DVD in 2010. It goes onto television in 2011. And come 2012, you release the director's cut on DVD. So it's a way of maximizing. There's nothing
to do with the Olympics.
No, because the Olympics don't get mentioned either. It's like looking at an accountancy sheet, okay? The movie, the plot of the movie, nothing to do with Earth's core temperature, nothing to do with global, nothing to do with any of that. It's an accounting thing, okay? We are going to spend $250 million and we need to recoup that. And in order for the money to be made back, really the movie's got to turn something like $500 million. And you look at you know, something like Titanic, which was like 1.8 billion over the course of the years. Then you look the other way, Waterworld, that cost around 200 million, only took 250 million, which, you know, because by the multiplication, you have to get 2.5 times what the movie cost. So we figure it over 4 years. So it's like the plot of the film is essentially the balance sheet. It's like an accountant wrote the plot. An accountant did the sums, figured out the interest, and said, I'd call it 2012. If the budget was less, it'd probably been 2011, because we would have been able to recoup the money earlier. That's the first point. The second point is that quite apart from the baggy stuff at the beginning, which is incredibly, you know, long and doing all the setup and, you know, earthquake, yeah, Gaia, go on, get on, just get on with the stuff happening.
Hurry up
and destroy the world, okay? What you get is this almost farcical checklist of all the things that you've seen before in disaster movies. I started to list them down. And it's just so quite apart from the fact that obviously all disaster movies owe something to the Cecil B. DeMille, you know, biblical epics in which bad stuff happens and then there's a flood or bad stuff happens and there's a rain of fire, Sodom and Gomorrah, all that sort of stuff happens, fine. So that's where that's the template for it. But okay, in 2012 we have the tidal wave, which comes from Deep Impact and a bunch of other films. We have the ocean liner turning over, which is the Poseidon Adventure. We have the fiery buildings falling down, which is Towering Inferno, and obviously seen to be post 9/11, which incidentally the BBFC mentioned in their report. We have the cracks in the pavements appearing and the cars falling down and the people falling down to them, which is Earthquake, which is the Charlton Heston movie. We've got the Black President, because that obviously now happened since Deep Impact. That is the rule of that's how that has to work. We've got the relationship getting sorted out. This is the most important thing. The relationship getting sorted out because there's also the dog getting out of the fiery inferno, which I think is from Volcano, but is the rule of disaster movies, you can't kill the dog, okay? You can't kill the dog. Exactly, because you'll alienate the audience. But at the centre of it, you have, and see whether you can figure this out, okay? You know the way disaster movies work is that they set up all these characters have character traits, they have stuff to do, right? And the disaster comes, which is some great big cataclysmic event, but in fact, what we're meant to be focused on is the individual character arcs of the people that we showed to. So at the beginning of the film, okay, John Cusack, he is a failed author, who has a failed marriage, who doesn't spend enough time with his kids. Okay? Now, also in this drama, there is a sort of Russian oligarch who has loads and loads of money and has bought himself a place on one of the ships, and he's very unpleasant. He has two children who are very unpleasant, but they're his. And then we have a sort of flibbertigibbet type woman who has met one of the other characters through plastic surgery, but is treated very badly by the Russian. Now, just see if, on the basis of that, you can do the plot maths on how this works out. Okay, world is ending. What happens to all those characters? Do you think, or shall I let you do it? Do you think that during the arc of the movie, John Cusack will become a successful author who saves his marriage and spends more time with his children?
Well, you're not going to have time to write a book, are you, if the world's
collapsing? You don't have to write a new book. The book that you wrote already that was unsuccessful might turn out to be strangely prophetic.
Oh, I see.
His failed book was all about the heating up of the Earth's core.
Yeah,
exactly. Failed book. But it was also about the way in which humanity can look after itself, because there's a message in all this. Even when the mountains are falling and the seas are rising, human beings... I'm turning to Carl Sagan. Am I standing on windswept Scotland? Human beings have a connection to each other.
It's the name of his book, Look Out, Her Madge Will Be on the Boat First.
That's right, yes. Get out. I'm the queen and I'm bringing my cookies. So, okay, could that possibly... Do you think there's any possibility that the really badly behaved Russian oligarch who's, you know, is going to come to a sticky end? Do you think there's any what do you think will happen to the kids? The kids are bad, but they're kids. What do you think will happen to the doc?
They'll get looked after by that
same
girl.
Rule as the doc now. And it was like, at one point I thought, you know what he's going to do, he's going to be subversive and he's going to kill the wrong people.
But kill
then you
the
go,
dog.
Then you go, no, yes, exactly. You're going to kill dog. And the wrong people are going to survive. But it is like the, so the plot is an accountancy sheet. The character arcs are like somebody went, you got that? Yeah, you got that character. You got that? He's got to do that. Hang on, he's got to map that. Fine. Yeah. How long are we into this yet? 2 hours. Fine. Okay. Make the book successful. Do the bit with the thing. Now, third part. One of the great joys of disaster movies in the past has been actually watching the stunts. If you see Poseidon Adventure, the Irwin Allen thing, okay? The scene in Poseidon Adventure when the boat turns over, it was at that time the biggest single drop that a stuntman had ever done. You know, the guy's hanging onto the table and he falls through the boat and he lands in the chandelier because the whole thing about Poseidon Adventure is up becomes down, right? And you go, wow, I saw the Poseidon Adventure 4 or 5 times at the ABC Arnos Grove because the stunts, you know, incredible stunts, right? And Towering Inferno, the bit where they're hanging on the, you know, on the bosun's boy and you know that people have really orchestrated these things well. And even if it's model work, it's good model work. Now with CGI, there's no skill involved at all. You just go, well, I want a plane flying through a building as it collapses, and what's it? Can you do that? Yeah, I'll just draw it. Okay. There was in that review of Terminator Salvation, in which Jeff Smith from Radio 1 had liked it because he said it's incredible. You know, a helicopter's crashing and a camera goes through the helicopter. You go, yeah, it's CGI. Nobody cares. Anybody can do that. Nowadays, it's CGI. Just go, what can you think of? I can think of a three-headed Hydra coming out of the back of a jet plane. And it doesn't make any difference. I'll just draw it and I'll just do it. So you don't get any of that thrill that you ever got in disaster movies of actually watching people do stunts, actually watching things actually happen. You don't get the sense that you did with Live and Let Die. Remember when the car goes up and jumps over the river in a real car, really jumps over a real river. Okay, it's a stunt driver. Okay, it's a stunt car. Okay, they've set it up. Doesn't make any difference. You still went, wow, look at that. A real car really did this. But with this, the planet's falling apart and the buildings are coming down and the airplane's going up. And you're just going, yeah, but you just drew that on a computer and I'm not very interested. Plus, there is a basic rule which goes like this. Any cataclysmic disaster, really genuinely cataclysmic disaster, has after effects that last longer than 17 days. Sorry. That's just how it works, okay? You cannot get over cataclysmic disasters in very short... And you cannot do happy, oh, well, that's all right. Then, you know, most of the world wiped out, but blimey... So without...
You're not giving too much away.
No, I'm not giving it, because the end of the world movie... End of the world movie. You are paying to see an end of the world movie about the end of the world.
Only with moderate threat.
Made by somebody who saves the dog. Now, you can figure out for yourself, in that case, what happens... In 2012. It is boring. It is bombastic. There is no skill in it. It is demonstration that computer graphics have no weight. It is plodding. It is written by accountants and people who have drawn character arcs from going back through the accounts of previous disaster movies and going, join the dots there, 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 and there. And it is, you know, it is just dull as anything.
Does that make Roland Emmerich Mr. Bombastic?
Mr. Bombastic, very fantastic.
So have the Olympics happened, do you think? I mean, have they already happened? And
no,
then
the end of the world stops it. Although it happens very fast. I mean, literally, they go, solar flares, oh, world's heating up, blimey, better get to those ships.
Right, so but is it post-Olympics or not? Do we know?
Nobody mentions the Olympics. The Queen certainly doesn't bring it up as she scurries onto the boat with her corgis.
Someone's written about this. Adrian... Chell says HM the Q wasn't running to the ship to escape. She was actually racing to officially launch it.
Oh,
which you, very which
good,
you,
very good.
You talk about the American sort of centric nature of these disaster movies. Mm. Is that my favourite bit in Deep Impact, which we were discussing?
Yeah,
on telly was there's a moment early on where they know this stuff is coming from space, and they get all the world scientists together. And they where's it going to hit? They're all, you know, I'm not quite sure. Let's use our computer projections. And they were sitting all gathering, waiting for the moment. And it comes up, Manhattan. And they go, and everyone else is going, where else was it going to be? Why are you surprised it's Manhattan? Of course it's Manhattan. Thing, it was never going to be France, was it?
But fantastically, when it's announced that these things are happening in foreign countries, right, they're happening around the Eiffel Tower. They're happening around Big Ben. They're happening around... It is like that bit in Team America World Police when they go to, you know, Bacadacalaca Street. And the world consists... It's like the World's Fair. It is just the landmarks that the Americans recognise and that's it.
Tim in Nottingham, Mark just said nothing should be 2 hours and 40 minutes long. Well, I beg to differ.
Yeah, go down,
the special edition of Aliens is 2 hours and 40 minutes long, as are most of Lord of the Rings films.
Yes, I
These
stand corrected.
Are all great films that are made so well, they don't actually feel that long, unlike so many other films today that are shorter but feel longer.
Yeah, I did feel when I came out of 2012 that it probably was 2012.
so many years had
yes,
gone past.
Yes, it was like, but he was just, you know, it's the thing. You just, you're going, oh, you know, if it's just like a fiery building or a boat turning over, we can get there quite fast. But if it's, oh, the whole world's got to end, you go, how am I going to be here forever? You know, what day, I'm an hour in there, stuff hasn't even happened yet. And anyway, I liked all those proper disaster movies the first time round. And the thing about watching very famous buildings get knocked down, which of course we saw, you know, famously in Endgame, I'm all for that, no problem with that. Good bit of spectacle if it's done properly. But, you know, the planes flying through the thing, it's like CGI, I don't care. Don't care. Don't care that you sat down and said to some computer nerd, you know what, I'm a bit busy, I'm going away for 3 days. When I come back, can you do me a shot of an aeroplane flying through? The other thing, it's a film in which aeroplanes take off from runways, the earth falls down, and somehow the plane manages to end up below skyscrapers. You go, hang on, what? Are you up? Where are we?
I'm still going to like it, I'm sure.
You're not.
Okay.
You're not. It's so boring. It's going to do your back in.
Yeah, I'll take my lumbar support cushion, and all will be well. Saw 6 in French is sausage, because it's saucisse. John O'Wilf in Barcelona say in Spain, to saw is serra. And so you could translate Saw 6 as psoriasis. That's what they're calling it there, which is slightly odd. Anyway, they also say, the great cinema experience is not dead. I took my 6-year-old to see Up on Saturday morning. We had something that is rarely mentioned these days, a perfect cinema trip.
Hey.
Yes, it's still possible. It's a great film. There are only 2 other people in the cinema, brilliant. None with mobile phones.
Brilliant.
We shared tasty popcorn. He behaved himself, and I secretly blubbed on at least 4 occasions.
Very good.
It was like a flash of good news on a bad day. We came out feeling tip-top. Simple as that. Mind you, we don't go that often, and it was a Sunday morning showing. So
very
it was a
good.
Perfect
very,
experience.
Very good.
You might not want to take your 6-year-old to the new
Harry Brown
Michael Caine movie. Let me just say, before we go any further, hello to Jay Isaacs.
Yes.
F Convention. M Sheen, who I'm speaking to very shortly.
Yes. Actually. Are you? Okay.
Yeah. S Fry. And I think we can add D Tennant.
D Tennant.
Our new best friend.
Yeah, your new best friend.
Well, Mike
he
specific.
Loves you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Harry Brown.
He's
back. He's a pensioner and he's got a big gun.
So that's the tagline. Michael Caine was on the program the other
day.
He
was absolutely fantastic.
Okay, well, so very quickly, everybody knows this. So the story is Michael Caine is an old codger. He plays an old codger, Harry Brown, living on an estate. His best and indeed only friend is set upon by vile and evil hoodies. And so he does the Charles Bronson death wish thing, which is he remembers that he used to be a fighting man. He decides there's no reason he can't become a fighting man again. And he goes out to dish out some proper justice. Here's a clip.
Tell me what happened in the subway with Leonard. Marky.
Who's Leonard?
He's the man you and your mates murdered. So what happened, son?
Bruv, I don't know what you're talking about.
Tell me what happened to Leonard. Now listen, if you won't tell me, I'm going to do both your kneecaps, one at a time, until you do. So what's it going to be?
And now I've got to say, I'm sorry. It's the best line of the film. If you don't tell me, I'm going to do both your kneecaps one at a time until you do. Which mean what? He's only got 2. What do you mean until you do? Once you've done both of them one at a time, you can't keep doing them.
Well,
he was just
making the point that he wasn't going to do them both together.
I'm not going to do both your kneecaps together.
Cross your legs.
Then
I can do both together with one body.
Yeah, that's right. No, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep doing it one at a time. To both of them, until you tell me what happened to them. I'm sorry, I can't do it. Nobody can do Michael. Okay, so, you've seen the film, right?
I have, indeed.
Let's start on the plus side. It's very hard to take against anything Michael Caine does, because he does have a kind of effortless grace, which we've seen used in so many different ways over the years. There was a period in which there was a joke about Michael Caine doing anything, you know, doing Jaws for the Revenge and all that stuff. And Spitting Image had a character in which Michael Caine gets the yellow pages in the post and rings it. I'll do it, just doing anything at all. I've got a birthday card, I'll do it. There is now such a sort of back catalogue and such a history with him that he does, you know, he does have genuine stature and gravitas. And it is very, very hard to take against anything with him in. I have to say that there is, and also as somebody who, if you look, for example, at a film like Dead Man's Shoes, which takes the Death Wish, you know, Death Weekend kind of revenge narrative and does something with it, I don't actually have a problem with the idea of revenge movies. But there is something about, no, it's not something, there is very much about the morality of Harry Brown, which is at very best questionable and at very worst very, very hard to take.
Particularly if you only read The Guardian.
Particularly, well, no, but it's, you know, people have described it as a Daily Mail morality, but I don't buy that kind of shorthand. Here's the thing. Look, in America, Clint Eastwood becomes known as, you know, the great enforcer character, right? Then late in life he makes Unforgiven, and then later in life he makes Gran Torino, in which he essentially revives the Dirty Harry character and says, you know what, actually violence isn't going to solve anything. This in a country, incidentally, in which execution is legal and buying guns is legal. Meanwhile, in Britain, where execution is not legal and buying guns is not legal, we have Michael Caine starring in a movie which basically says, you know, the answer to today's problems is we need more people going out and shooting hoodies. And as far as that kind of idea, I was talking before about paedophobic horror tracks, as far as paedophobic movies is concerned, this is a movie which its entire sort of raison d'etre is, you know those hoodies, blimey Charlie, are they bad? And what we need is somebody's going to say, now, even if you look at a film like Death Wish, which is based on a book, there is a sense in Death Wish that in the vigilantism, there is something bad happening, that this isn't going to solve anything. This is not going to solve the problems. You know, vigilantism is not going to help. I did, and I hope you did too, had a...
You're going to lecture me now.
No, I'm not. I'm asking you a serious question. Did you not feel uncomfortable about the fact that... I mean, I know it's very dangerous to ever read the message of a film as a single thing, but did you not feel that the thrust of the movie, which is hoodies, they're really, 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 really horrible, and you know what? Somebody going out with a gun and sorting them out, well, actually, did that not give you any pause for...
I think it felt like, I mentioned this to Michael Caine in the interview, it's like the opposite of a Ken Loach film, right? So Ken Loach would say, here are these awful people, but look at their backgrounds, this is how they've ended up in the terrible state, which actually is what Michael Caine actually thinks, because he said he spent a lot of time talking to these lads and what they need. He said they've been let down, they should have had an education, they've been let down.
Yeah, but
it's taken from, it's a movie, it's taken from the point of view of a victim, and and that's what Michael Caine is, and he is a victim, and he sets out to go and do something about it.
Yeah, I know, but there is such thing as a kind of, you know, an underlying morality in films. I'm not saying, you know, good or bad, it just, films do have an ethos, at least when they're properly made, they do.
Well, I think what's
interesting, and I have to say, to its credit, it is properly made.
Yes.
It does have an ethos, and it is a film which is consistent and of a piece. It's just that the piece that it is of, it leans so heavily towards a kind of reactionary bolder.
Well, it's being reviewed very, very politically, which again, so we mentioned with Michael Caine yesterday, and that is, those of a maybe more conservative disposition, like Matthew D'Ancona, who was writing about it, saying this is a very important film, and this is what the estates are like, and they've been neglected.
Oh, it's not important.
And we really, really need to do something about it, and those of a Guardian reading sensibility.
No, it's not important. I think it's not. It's a lot of things, but it's not important.
Frank in Leeds, saw Harry Brown last night. This looks like a remake of Death Wish centred on a London estate. I think it carries more weight. It rung more bells for me than Tom Clancy's book Without Remorse, where a Navy SEAL slowly killed all the drug dealers that had a hand in the killing of his girlfriend. Former serviceman used his military skills to avenge his friend's death. The film was excellently shot. Everyone seemed wholly believable, including the completely ineffectual police. It's just a pity that you can't give him an award for the film, because it would seem to be politically incorrect. Alex Eve saying it has mesmerising photography, an extraordinary storyline, brilliant performances by Caine as well as Emily Mortimer.
It's a bad part.
And surprising appearances by Skins' Jack O'Connell. It was, put simply, a must-see. Please say The Good Doctor agrees with me. Can't wait to see what Daniel Barber does in the future.
No, I don't. I mean, I think that he is a talented filmmaker. And as I said, I think the film is technically well put together. And it does have a single mind, and it is of a piece. I just don't like the piece that it is of.
If you would like to download the podcast, that will be available very, very shortly. But if you need to know, if you have just joined us, what the movie of the week is, and you're expecting it to be mentioned now in the last 10 seconds, as is a tradition, I'm afraid you've missed it.
Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon. That's a laugh riot of a film.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
If that podcast wasn't enough, visit my Uncut blog at www.bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode for video reviews, anecdotes, and the chance to let me know your opinions.